only evidence we have for unintelligent life on Venus. Down on the bottom, you can see that in the first place, everything looks flat, as though what you're seeing there is just a rock sheet with perhaps some breaks in it here and there, like these cracks, but more or less a rock sheet where the soil is not covering it. And in both pictures, you are seeing soil in between the rocks, or here maybe covering parts of the sheet, maybe not. Let's call the places where this sheet comes to Earth, comes to the surface, what we would call it on Earth, and that is outcrops. The next thing that's so obvious if you look at it is from looking at the way the rocks look there and looking at the way the rocks look there. In the Venera 9 picture, we have landed on a hillside. You are looking uphill in this direction and downhill, remember this is almost 180 degrees away, in this direction, and so that is where you are seeing the farthest. On the Venera 10 picture, you have landed in a flat, open plain. I don't think that I mentioned the places on Venus where Venera 9 and 10 landed. They landed at two places, one of them latitude 15 degrees north, the other latitude 31 degrees north, and at almost exactly the same longitude, so one was due north of the other. And if you would like two places on the Earth which are at the same latitudes, and one is essentially due north of the other and is offset by just the same amount as the Venera 9 and Venera 10 places are, Guatemala City and the middle of Mississippi would do it just fine. So if you imagine one of them in Guatemala City and the other in middle Mississippi, that's just as far apart as they are on the surface of Venus. Well, what you seem to have here in both cases is a sheet of rock, which may very well be basaltic lava, but in the top case, you have landed on a hillside. The spacecraft is more tilted than the hillside itself, apparently because one edge of that donut-shaped landing device came down on one of the rocks and is tilted over by it. But the slope of the hillside is something of the order of 15 or 20 degrees. And the hillside is covered by sharp, angular rocks. On Earth, any geologist would wait about 2 seconds before saying what that is. It's a talus slope. Or if you're a mountain climber, it's what you call a scree. That is to say, a hillside which is covered by jagged blocks of rock which have recently been dislodged from the mountain by erosion and are slowly creeping downhill under the influence of gravity. There's only one small problem. What does the dislodging and what makes it possible to move downhill under the influence of gravity in both cases is the presence on Earth of water. What breaks up the solid bedrock of which the planet Earth is made into individual boulders is water expanding and contracting as the seasons go by, and it freezes and therefore expands and melts and therefore contracts as the temperature changes alternately the water from solid to liquid. I guarantee we don't have that on Venus. And what makes it possible for them to creep slowly down slope is that water comes along in the form of rain or the form of runoff from snowmelt or whatever and undermines the soil, and slowly a piece of rock one by one will fall down. So what can generate a talus slope on Venus is at the moment a mysterious question. But it seems pretty evident that that's what we're on, and the source of it is unfortunately out of the picture in the 180 degrees that we can't see up there on the top of the hill, which would be over there somewhere. Oh, I said that they are angular, and the significance of that is that if rocks are weathered, are destroyed, are broken down by any process, no matter what that process is, chemical, physical, you name it, it always attacks corners first, because a corner has two sides exposed to it, whereas if you're in the middle of a face between corners, you've only got one side exposed. In other words, what I'm saying is that any rock, as it gets weathered, becomes progressively more rounded. And so what we're seeing is relatively young rocks, recently generated surface in the top picture, relatively old surface down there in the bottom of the picture. There's only one place in the Venera 10 picture where there seem to be jagged corners, and that is here and then also here. And if you make a map showing what this scene would look like if you could see it from directly above, you get a truly remarkable finding. That piece fits right into that hole like a jigsaw puzzle. What apparently has happened is it has become dislodged. Now, there is a geologist at Wayne State named Luciano Ronca, whom many of you may have heard speak here at Michigan State. He's done so several times, and who has worked with the Russians on these pictures, and who very kindly gave me a good deal of information about them. One of the things that Ronca suspects is that what we're seeing here may not be a sheet of rock per se, as some of this soil, whatever it is, stuck together to form a sort of sedimentary rock. What would do the sticking together is an open question. On Earth, it would be mostly calcium carbonate deposited by evaporating liquid water. On Venus, I guarantee it's not that, but with all the chemistry that must be going on at the surface of Venus in that temperature and pressure, it may very well be that there are possibilities. And part of the reason that he thinks that is that, number one, you have features like this, and you don't expect to see that kind of thing if you just have a bunch of rocks that form more or less in the shape that you see them. And then number two, a number of the rocks in the Venera 9 picture, those are the ones that are younger and less eroded, and therefore you can see more what they look like when they form, a number of those rocks show evidence of layering. The McDonald's hamburger is the obvious one, but there are several others. There's one, there's one, there's one, there's one, and so forth. Layering within the rock on that small a scale is characteristic of a sedimentary deposit. It is not characteristic on that scale of lava, especially basaltic lava. So it may very well be that there are, of all things, sedimentary rocks on the surface of this waterless planet. A couple more spacecraft components, which it's now necessary to point out. First of all, I draw your attention again to the donut-shaped landing device, and there is the cover, the dust cover of the camera. This thing here, which looks like a hammer, in fact, it's about it. It's a gadget which uses gamma rays to be sent through the rock to measure the density of the rock. And to make sure you're in the rock, as soon as the spacecraft comes down, in fact, even before it begins taking pictures, picture begins being taken two minutes after the landing, and even before that, this thing slams down into the rock as hard as it can. It lands about as hard as the head of a sledgehammer and drives itself into the surface. In both cases, you can see that it is lying on the surface of rock and not some of that soil, and so what it measured the density of was in fact rock and not some of the soil. In the case of the top picture, the Venera 9, it's either lying on the rock and it hasn't damaged it, or quite likely it has broken this particular rock that it's landing and landed on into two, but either way it's a hard material. Well, that was one of the two devices on the Venera 9 and 10 landers which were used to get a hint of what the composition of the surface material was. You understand, you can't do the same thing here as you did on the Viking landers, which made direct measurements of chemical composition and took weeks to do it. You don't have weeks. You've only got about an hour. So you've got to do it in a quick and dirty way. One way was to measure the density. And the other way was to measure the radioactivity of the rock. Now, any rock has very, very tiny amounts of essentially any atom that you care to mention in it. There's gold in any rock in your backyard. There's not enough gold that the value of it would be anything like the value of the energy that would be needed to get out the gold, but nevertheless, it is there, and if you're a geochemist, that gold might be important to you, not because it's valuable, but because it's scientifically valuable. You could learn some things about the history of the rock from it. And any rock contains very small trace amounts, not enough to harm you, of course, but of the radioactive substances, uranium, thorium, and the radioactive isotope of potassium, potassium-40. Those amounts are characteristic of the kind of rock. Radioactivity measurement. And the question is so important that nobody is going to start basing major theories about the history of the Earth on one single radioactivity measurement like that. It's a very important question. One of these days we'll find out the answer. For the time being, bear it in mind, but just because of this one set of data, don't go taking it for granted. I'm going to skip over this because we're getting so late, and that, as I thought, was my last slide. And so now what I'm going to do is show you, assuming that I can find the switch for this machine here, show you why it is that Venus rotates in the way that it does. I'm going to do this as fast as I can. You will recall that there are two things that have to be explained. Number one, Venus rotates so very, very slowly, in fact, so slowly that its year is longer than its day, and number two, why Venus rotates in the wrong direction from Earth, and from most of the other planets. In other words, it rotates from east to west, so the sun would rise in the west instead of in the east. Most planets rotate from west to east. Well, let's start out with the moon, which is a nice simple case, easy to understand. The moon does rotate. This is a point that people seem to find very difficult to understand, but it does, it is true. The fact that we cannot see the back of the moon from Earth means that the moon must rotate. If the moon did not rotate, we would see all sides of it during the course of one revolution of the moon around the Earth. Let this be the Earth, and suppose we have the moon here, and we are going to let it go around the Earth like that, and come back here. And let this be some mountain which is pointed right at the Earth, so that as seen from Earth at that particular moment, that mountain is in the center of the disk of the moon. Actually, it so happens there's not a mountain there, there's a mare called Sinus Medii, but don't worry about it, I'm going to pretend it's a mountain. All right, because it's easier to draw a little arrowhead. If the moon didn't rotate, that mountain is now pointing like that, right? If the moon didn't rotate, okay, quarter of an orbit later, the mountain is pointing right that. It's not pointing at the Earth anymore. In fact, we're seeing it at the edge of the disk. If the moon didn't rotate half a revolution later, that mountain would be pointing directly away from the Earth, and we would see the exact opposite hemisphere that we saw when we started out. Okay? Everybody got that? Now let the moon rotate once per revolution. Everybody know the difference between these words, rotation and revolution? Rotation means spinning around your axis. Revolution means moving around something in a circle. The Earth revolves around the sun once a year. The Earth rotates on its axis once a day. The reason you may be confused about those words is they are customarily misused in everyday life. You have a rotating door. You don't have a revolving door. You have the kind of gun which should be called a rotator. A record turns to 33 and a third rotations per minute, and so forth. Okay? So, let the moon rotate once per month. All right? Here we have the mountain pointing at the Earth. Here we get a quarter of a way around, and the moon has rotated so that mountain keeps pointing at the Earth, and now it looks like this, not like that. And can you see how the moon has rotated a quarter of a turn, as well as revolved a quarter of a turn? Let it get around to the other side, and the mountain still keeps pointing at the Earth, all the time pointing at the Earth, so instead of having this situation, what you have is the moon having turned around exactly once, and the mountain is still pointing at the Earth. I think you can see if we go around the rest of the way, the moon will turn on its axis exactly once as it revolves around the Earth exactly once. So, what I have to explain in the case of the moon is why there's this remarkable coincidence that you have one rotation exactly per revolution. Obviously, it's not coincidence. Something must have happened to cause it. Well, what's happened to cause it is this. Suppose you have any body revolving around any other, and this could be Venus revolving around the sun just as well as the moon revolving around the Earth. So let me call them the primary, the big one in the middle, and the secondary, the one that is revolving around the primary. And let the secondary be rotating with respect to the primary, turning around rapidly. All right? Venus may very well have started out that way. All the other planets seem to be rotating fairly rapidly, except Mercury. And Mercury is even closer to the Sun than Venus. It doesn't take very much imagination to realize that if all the others are fast and the two closest to the Sun are where the tidal force is strongest are the slowest, that they've gotten slowed down, and what slows them down is the Sun's tidal force. Did I say tidal force? I certainly did. The primary attempts to raise tides in the solid rock that the planet is made of. In fact, it does more than attempt. It succeeds. The moon does that even to the Earth. When the moon is directly overhead and the tide is maximum, the solid Earth beneath your feet is 3 inches farther from the center of the Earth than when the tides are at a minimum. It actually flexes up and down. As a matter of fact, that is one of the major processes that crack rock on the Earth. Okay? That tidal bulge is pointing in what direction? Well, remember, we're rotating here, and you would think the tidal bulge would be pointing directly at the object that is causing it, but it's not. And the reason for that is that rock is not, or any solid, is not perfectly elastic. If you deform it by some force, it takes a little while to feel the force, and then if the force goes away, it takes a little while for the force to go away. It doesn't happen instantaneously. And so you form that tidal bulge, but if the planet is rotating too, then the tidal bulge gets carried around past the direction towards the primary. It isn't here where I've drawn it. It's over here somewhere. Of course, I'm exaggerating its size so you can see it. Okay? Just because the rock is not perfectly elastic. Now, those of you who know about tides know that there is also another tidal bulge on the opposite side. That is not important for this particular discussion, but it's there, so I'll make you happy by putting it in. All right? That tidal bulge constitutes an excess of material. And so the gravity of the sun attracts that material toward the sun. Never mind that it was that very same gravity that produced the bulge in the first place. The fact remains that if the bulge is there, it constitutes a mass, and that mass will be attracted toward the sun. And here comes the crux of the matter. Since it has been carried past the point that is pointing directly at the sun is pulling it back at an angle. And in doing so, it is trying to slow the rotation of the planet. Do you see that? It must slow the rotation of the planet. Suppose the planet is rotating the other direction. Well, then the bulge rotates this direction. Then the bulge is on that side, carried past the sun direction by the rotation, and again, the sun pulls it backwards. Now, this other bulge is being pulled toward the sun, too, and it's trying to speed up the rotation, but it's a little bit further away from the sun. Therefore, the gravity back there is a little bit less, and so it's a close thing, but this one wins. The rotation gets slowed down. It will slow until finally, let me draw another diagram over here, this is getting cluttered, until finally the bulge is pointing directly at the sun, and the other one's pointing directly away from it, and is always pointing directly at the sun, so that now there is no twist in either direction, and once that condition is reached, it is equilibrium, and the planet will keep pointing at the sun forever and ever. Everybody happy so far? That's why the moon points at the Earth. Mercury does roughly the same thing, a little bit more complicated. Mercury goes around the sun once, and as it does so, it rotates on its axis exactly, not once, but 1.5 times. And the reason Mercury is able to pull that off, it came as quite a shock when we found that it did it, but Mercury has an orbit which is not perfectly circular and doesn't have the sun in the center. I'm exaggerating that effect a lot here, but it is a significant effect. Tidal force is much stronger when Mercury is closest to the sun than when it's farther away. The tidal force does not vary as the inverse square of the distance from the sun. As many of you may know, the gravitational force itself does. Tidal force is the difference between two gravitational forces, one a little bit closer to the sun, one a little bit further away. It varies as the inverse force power of the distance. And that means that you get a little closer and you have a lot stronger tide. I realize that to many of you that was Greek, but I threw it in for those of you who wish I would do some math occasionally. There is some. And what that means, by the way, is that the tidal force exerted on Venus by the sun is a little bit stronger than the tidal force exerted on Earth by the moon. So it is a good, strong tidal force. All right, Mercury, one of those bulges, points at the sun when it's at perihelion, the point closest to the sun. And then Mercury goes around and it spins, and the bulge actually points away from the sun, but when it comes back, it is turned exactly 1.5 times, so the opposite bulge is pointing exactly at the sun. All right? Let it go around again, it spins 1.5 times, and the first bulge is pointing right at the sun. So again, you've got a tidal lock. It's not as simple a lock as that nice 1-to-1 rotation to revolution. This is 3-to-2, but it's still a tidal lock. It's just opposite bulges instead of the one. In fact, if you started the moon spinning, say a big asteroid came along and hit it a glancing blow, started spinning, the chances would be only a little better than even that it would end up in the 1-to-1 lock that it's got now. There's about a 40% chance that it would end up in the 3-to-2 lock that Mercury has with respect to the sun. Then we would alternately, on opposite months, see the near side of the moon and the far side of the moon at a given point in the moon's orbit, and every other point in between. Kind of neat. Okay, back to Venus. I seem to have shown in that last diagram that Venus has got to point one side toward the sun at all times, don't I? I seem to have painted myself into a very nice little corner. Venus goes around the sun once in 225 Earth days, so I seem to have shown that Venus has got to rotate once in 225. Its day should be equal to its year, but that is not the case. Venus rotates in a day that is longer than its year, 243. What's the difference? The difference is that Venus, unlike Mercury and the Moon, has an atmosphere. And the atmosphere has a different kind of tide in it. Let me draw you the atmospheric tide on yet another diagram. I have shown you how, there's the planet, there is the line towards the sun, and here is the direction of rotation, and so the tidal bulge in the rock is carried away by a little bit of an angle, and the sun pulls it in such a direction that it tries to slow down the rotation. But there is also an atmosphere on Venus, and the atmosphere is being heated by the sun. The place where it is hottest is a place where the gas expands, right? Hot air expands. The place where it is coldest is the place where the air contracts. You say, now wait a minute, how can it have different densities at different points on the same planet? Surely it'll move from one place to the other. No, because it expands and contracts in such a way as to keep the pressure always the same. And a hot gas that is thinner has the same pressure as cold gas that is thicker. So, where the gas is coldest is where the gas is densest. Got that? Where it's heaviest. Where on the planet is the gas densest, i.e. coldest? Not at the midnight point. Because again, just as the rock is not perfectly elastic, air doesn't respond instantaneously to changes in incoming radiation. It takes a while to cool off. Keeps cooling off all through the night. The place where the air is coldest, and we're talking now here, of course, not about the air close to the surface of Venus, where the greenhouse effect keeps it the same temperature all the time, the air a little bit higher up, where there are temperature variations. The place where it is coldest turns out to be just about the place where the sun is rising. In other words, the place that is having not midnight, but dawn. Where is that place? Well, if the planet is rotating this way, that place is right about there. And I'm going to draw schematically that densest region of air as a little blob in that particular place. Now, please note that this place is around about 90 degrees away from the line to the sun. And since it is a mass excess, it is a place where there is more air per unit volume than elsewhere, a denser place, the sun's gravity is going to pull it too, and it's going to pull it in such a direction as to speed up the rotation. So you've got two poles. And please note, there is no other tidal bulge. There's only one place in all the air where it's hottest, where it's coldest. Hottest is 180 degrees away, not 90 degrees away. So the pull of the sun on the rock bulge is slowing down the rotation. And the pull of the sun on the atmosphere bulge is speeding up the rotation. Those two twists will balance each other. How do they balance each other? Well, the amount of this pull on the rock bulge is great. There's a lot of rock. Rock is heavy. Air doesn't wear very much. Not much of a pull over there. Doesn't weigh very much. On the other hand, the angle that the rock bulge is away from the lines of the sun is pretty small. It's not anything like as big as I've drawn here. If I drew it correctly, you'd never see it, so I had to exaggerate. So it's a big pole, but it's a pole almost straight towards the sun. There's not much of a twist to it, since the angle is so small. The atmosphere pole is a pole on a much smaller amount of mass, but a much bigger twist. You've got a 90-degree lever arm there. And so it turns out, when you do the calculation, that those two twists are roughly equal. Finally, the amount of the twist on the rock bulge depends on how fast the rotation is, because the faster the rotation, the more the rock bulge is carried past the sun line, and the bigger twist the sun can exert. So they will adjust themselves until the two twists are equal, and then you will be in equilibrium, and lo and behold, when you plug into the formulae that describe each of the two twists, reasonable values for the elasticity of the rock of Venus and for the thermal inertia of the air of Venus, the rotation period you end up with is 243 days. And there it is. Actually, it's close to 243. What makes it exactly 243 is yet another disturbing force, and that is, of all things, the gravity of the Earth. Venus's rotation is locked to the Earth. Not the simple way the Moon's is. It's not as though Venus always faces the same side to the Earth. Think about the geometry for a moment, you realize that's impossible. But consider a moment when Venus is as close to the Earth as it ever gets. There's the Sun, there's the orbit of Venus, there's the orbit of the Earth. Let's say the Earth is right there at a given moment. Venus cannot be closer to the Earth than when it's right here, directly between the Earth and the Sun. Can you see that? There's no other place you can put on this diagram where Venus can be closer to the Earth if the Earth is at this location. That moment is called inferior conjunction because Venus is right between the Sun and the Earth. On Sunday, Venus will be just the opposite, superior conjunction back there. Let's suppose there were a mountain on Venus which happened to be pointing directly at the Earth at inferior conjunction. Okay? Let time go by. Venus goes around the Sun fast. Earth goes around the Sun more slowly. After quite a long time, finally, there will come a time at a different place in the orbit where Venus is again pointing at the Earth, and that mountain will be pointing right at the Earth, too. So in that respect, we've seen all parts of Venus in between. But, I mean, we would have if we could see through the clouds. But in that respect, Venus's rotation is locked to the Earth in the same way as the Moon's is. Okay? How can this be? The Earth's tidal force on Venus is ridiculously tiny. It's like 50 times too small to be able to slow it down. Except that the Sun's tidal force is canceled out by the Sun's tidal force on the atmosphere, so the Earth fine-tunes it. So it's exactly 243 days, which is a period which gives you this condition that I've shown you. So that's it. All that was worked out by Andrew Ingersoll and a graduate student named Anthony Dobrovolskis at Caltech. And Dr. Ingersoll very kindly explained the whole thing to me over the phone, if you can imagine. I mean, it's hard enough for me to do it with diagrams here. He explained the whole thing over the phone and was able to get it through my head. And I want to give him credit for that. So, 11 o'clock, that's a good place to stop. Except, of course, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to take them until, well, I was going to say until the cows come home, but I can't because we get thrown out at 11:30, I'm told. But that gives us half an hour for questions, and so if we can have some lights on, I thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Let's give people who have to leave or want to leave a chance to do so, and wonder if I could ask you to put the dust cover back on my slides there. I must ask you, you are taping the questions too, right? Okay, I must ask you then, please, to ask questions into the microphones. There's a mic right here in front of me. Mic over there, conceivably even others, yes? Okay, we've got those three. And we must ask you to ask questions into those mics so that the questions will get taped also. They may or may not get broadcast, but, you know, give them the option. Okay, but I have to ask you to speak into a mic. That was fine. No, you have to speak right into it. We found this, we were a little casual about where people were with respect to the mic earlier with the result that it turned out you couldn't broadcast after questions. So I got to ask you to talk right into it.
Okay, the Venus shot you showed before, where you took a picture of it during the daytime.
Yes.
Was that a shot during elongation, or was it just no particular day?
Question is, at what stage in the orbit of Venus with respect to the Sun and the Earth, in other words, how far away in the sky from the Sun was Venus as seen from Earth, was that picture that I took of Venus in the daytime, was relatively close to elongation, that is, the farthest that Venus can get, but I also worried about brightness, and as I remember, it was somewhere between greatest elongation and greatest brightness. But see, what I did, I pulled a sneaky, which you couldn't see from that picture because I arranged it so you couldn't. I picked a day when I knew the moon would be sitting right next to Venus in the sky. I can find the moon in the daytime. Venus is hard. And by getting things like, for example, the very, very excellent sky calendar, which is put out by Abrams Planetarium here, which I highly recommend to any of you who are interested in following celestial events, naked eye celestial events. It's only $2 a year, and I think it's worth a lot more. Or you can go over and buy it for, what is it, 15 cents a copy or something like that? 10 cents a copy. You can find out what days Venus will be sitting right next to the moon in the sky. And then I just went out and found the moon, found Venus. And then, so you couldn't tell how I did it, moved around so Burton Tower was hiding the moon but not Venus. So you see, the important thing was not so much where was Venus as where was the moon. Because I needed to find the moon. After the moon, I could find Venus. Okay, other questions?
Has your astrophysicist friend never come up with an explanation for Venus's retrograde action?
I'm sorry. I knew I was leaving something out there. It was only a 3.5-hour lecture. I knew there was something that was missing, you know. I can't cover the whole world in 3.5 hours. Yeah, what happens is I can't explain why. I mean, Ingersoll himself didn't try to explain why. You got to go through all the equations. When you do a stability analysis on the rotation of Venus in the gravitational fields of the Sun, which get canceled out, see, and the Earth, which doesn't, then if everything were in exactly the same plane, if Venus's orbit were always exactly in the imaginary plane containing the center of the Sun and the center of the Earth, then indeed, either way, it would be stable. But of course, it's not. You have slight differences in the plane, which means that the Earth is pulling at Venus, say, the southern hemisphere a little bit at one time in its orbit, more than the northern hemisphere, another time otherwise. When you consider that fact, it turns out that a direct rotation, in other words, the normal direction of rotation in the solar system, is unstable in the sense that, given the slightest little perturbation, say due to the Earth's gravity, the inclination, let the plane of Venus's orbit be parallel to the floor and let the pencil that I'm holding here be Venus's rotation axis, the inclination gets greater and greater and greater and greater until it finally actually flips over. Now, if you take something that is rotating in, say, this direction, and then flip it over, can you see how it ends up rotating in the other direction? Okay? And when you do the same stability analysis for a retrograde rotation, it turns out that if you have a slight deviation from the 90-degree position, 90 degrees retrograde, the effect of a perturbation is to return it to 90 degrees. So what happens is, no matter how you start out, direct or retrograde, you flip over and you end up retrograde. Of course, the obvious question arises, too, why hasn't this happened with the Earth? Answer, we are much farther from the Sun. I mean, we're not that much further, but in tidal terms, we're very much further because tidal force falls off so rapidly with the distance from the Sun. And indeed, the Earth has been slowed down. We know that from fossil evidence. The Earth used to rotate more rapidly. Most of that, well, more of that than not, has been due to the Moon, which is a big planet sitting right next to us. But some of it has been due to the Sun. And if you give long enough, it's an age longer than the age of the solar system, whereas for Venus it's only a few hundred million years. But if you give it long enough, same thing will happen to the Earth. But it just hasn't happened yet. The solar system isn't old enough. In fact, it won't happen while the Sun is still shining.
Now that more facts are known about the Venusian atmosphere, have there been any theoretical proposals to manipulate the atmosphere at all?
So that it's more
Earth-like?
Oh, yeah, it's been suggested that you can, in a few centuries, you're not talking about doing this 10 years from now, in a few centuries we should have enough control over genetic engineering
to be able to design bacteria that would eat carbon dioxide and give off oxygen, and then conveniently die when the oxygen level reached enough high enough point. I'd hate to see it happen. I want to see Venus. I want to see all the planets reserved as national parks. We need to live in space fine. You've got to build space colonies out of asteroids. You've got much, much more room there. If you colonize all the terrestrial planets in the solar system, including the moons of the outer planets, you'd have only about 3 times the total land area of Earth. And the weather is just so miserable, you know, no matter what you do to it. So you take small bodies. I don't mind using them up. There are thousands of them. They're save a few, of course, but to a certain extent, it's a case of when you've seen one, you've seen them all. And use those and build your own artificial worlds from the ground up, literally, and then you've got what you want. So that sort of thing has been suggested, but I feel about that the same way I feel about cutting down redwoods to make boxes. You know, there are better things to do with redwoods. I think there are better things to do with Venus. Venus is a very, very interesting planet. It is certainly going to be centuries before we understand it fully, and I don't want to see anybody mess with it. I don't even want to see a manned landing on Mars, because it's going to mess up whatever is going on there. The life, if it is life, or the weird chemistry, if it's weird chemistry, you're going to bring in terrestrial bacteria, and you're going to do that if you have a manned landing. You've got to. There's no way around it. And you mess it up forever and ever. We don't need Mars, except to study what's going on there and learn some things. So the answer is, yeah, it's been thought of, but I hope they won't do it. You bet. Oh, yeah, one thing I should warn you about, the correct adjective for Venus, if you would like to be a snob like me, is not Venusian. It is Venerian. Okay? Adjectives for planets derive from the Latin possessives of their names. And so the correct adjectives, you don't say Marsian after all, you say Martian with a T, because the Latin possessive for Mars is Martis. Okay? So the correct adjectives for the planets are Mercutian, not Mercurian, Venerian, and if you don't like the sound of that, I'm sorry, Venus was the goddess of love and there's nothing you can do about it, terrestrial, right, lunar for the moon, Martian with a T, Jovian, Saturnian, Uranian, Neptunian, Plutonian. So it's Venerian. Some astronomers who don't like the sound of the word Venerian have discovered that there is an old Sicilian name for Venus, which was Cytherea. And so they've invented the, I admit, rather poetic sounding adjective Cytherean, and they think that sounds better. Whale, if you look up Cytherean in an unabridged dictionary, you will find that it has an interesting meaning. As I say, Venus was the goddess of love. Cytherean with a C.
You are describing the super refractivity and the dramatic and bizarre sunset that you could possibly experience in such an atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, there were no scattering, but inevitably there would be.
Can you relate this in any way to ashen light?
No. That's been thought of. The ashen light is a very faint glow of the night side of Venus, which has been reported sporadically for 3 centuries now by people who looked at Venus through telescopes. And I know it exists because I've seen it once in my life in 1957. And it looks very much like the Earth shine that you sometimes see on the dark side of the moon. Now that's caused by the Earth, which is of course illuminated by the sun, shining on the moon, lighting it up brightly enough that you can see it. Nothing to light up the moon that way. Nothing to light up Venus that way. People have tried to get it by having the Earth light up Venus, and there is no way you can get enough brightness that way. The slide that I skipped over, remember that? I knew somebody was going to get me on anything I skipped over. The slide that I skipped over was a spectrum of the night air glow on the rear side of Venus, which was taken from orbit by, in fact, such spectra were taken by both Venera 9 and 10, and I forget the particular slide that I showed you which it was from. And it turns out that there is, in fact, a fairly strong visible air glow on the night side. Now, air glow is the general term in astronomy for any faint glow of the gas up in the air. Okay, natural. The sort of analog to an aurora, but not the same thing. And Venus cannot have an aurora, per se, that is northern lights, because you need a magnetic field to generate that, and Venus has none. That's one of the many things that I didn't talk about. Or if it has one, it's very, very tiny. We are going to find out finally on the Pioneer Venus orbiter whether Venus has any magnetic field. It has a very sensitive magnetometer on it. probably what you'll be studying there is solar wind and so on. But, you know, if it has a magnetic field, doggone, we're going to find it out. The air glow is caused by the following process. On the day side of Venus, carbon dioxide, which of course makes up most of the atmosphere, is broken apart by ultraviolet sunlight into carbon monoxide, CO, right, carbon dioxide is CO2, carbon monoxide plus single oxygen atoms. Now, this is in the way upper atmosphere. If we're any lower down, single oxygen atoms are ferociously reactive chemically. They make ordinary oxygen, which is reactive enough. It rusts, you know, even when you don't light it. They make it look dead. Single oxygen is very, very reactive. It is what is responsible for the bleaching action of hydrogen peroxide, to take just one mild example. And those oxygen atoms would love to combine with practically anything. Now, the obvious suggestion you make is, why don't they recombine with carbon monoxide and give you carbon dioxide back again? Turns out there are quantum mechanical reasons why you can't do that. It's a forbidden transition. That will mean something to some of you, and to the rest of you, I'm going to have to ask you to take my word for it. It can't happen. Or rather, it happens, but it happens at a rate that is so low that it's not important. What happens instead is that the single oxygen atoms at this very, very low density remain in existence as single oxygen atoms long enough for the four-day circulation to carry them around on the night side of Venus, or something to carry them around on the night side. Now you're talking about so far in the upper air that we don't know what the circulation is. One of the things we're hoping to find out from the Pioneer Venus orbiter is that. That orbiter, by the way, is going to have an orbit which dips down into the upper atmosphere. Its closest approach will be only 80 miles above the surface of the planet. If you know about the Atmospheric Explorer series that has been used to study the upper atmosphere of Earth, these tough satellites that actually dip into the upper atmosphere of the planet itself, Pioneer Venus orbiter is very similar to that. In fact, a lot of the same people are on the team. So we'll get some direct measurements of the circulation of the atmosphere where this is happening. In any case, the oxygen goes around onto the night side. It lasts long enough as oxygen that it gets around onto the night side and finally combines, and what it normally combines with, more often than anything else, is other single oxygen atoms. And so what you get is O2. Oxygen molecule. When that happens, energy is given off in the form of visible light. Okay, that did everything except answer your question. When I heard about that, that was implicit in the Russian data, and it took Americans to figure it out. And the reason was, the Russians couldn't identify the spectral lines that they were seeing from their spectrometer on the orbit. And Charles Barth and Victor Argabright and somebody else at University of Colorado in Boulder eventually got a hold of their data and looked not only at the nighttime air glow spectral lines, but at the daytime of Venus, spectrum of Venus, which was taken by the same instrument and was faithfully radioed back to the Earth, although it is mostly a reflected spectrum of the Sun. And discovered something very interesting. They couldn't identify any of the lines in the spectrum of the Sun either from the wavelengths. And the reason was the Russians had managed to get the calibration off by 50 angstroms. And so, when Barth and Argabright and friends changed the wavelength by 50 angstroms so that all of the spectral lines in the Sun were the values they should have been, lo and behold, it turned out that the night air glow spectral lines corresponded to what you get when oxygen recombines in that way, which we don't see on the Earth because other things happen. Our atmosphere isn't made mostly of carbon dioxide, for one thing. And so that apparently is what's going on. So when I read about this in a paper in Science by those three gentlemen, I phoned them and got Barth, it was, on the phone. And he very kindly, and then I asked him this very question, you know, could this be the ashen light? And he said, the intensities that they measured are not observable from the Earth. You couldn't see them. But, in the first place, this ashen light is supposed to vary with the solar cycle. If you can believe it at all, apparently people see it more when sunspot activity is maximum than minimum.
And that's reasonable. The solar wind is hitting the upper atmosphere of Venus. There's no magnetic field to send it off the way there is on Earth. And so it could very well be that you have variation with the solar cycle. And if so, maybe occasionally you get enough of this activity going on to give you a much brighter nighttime light that you could actually see from the Earth. And secondly, we don't know anything about the upper atmospheric circulation of Venus. Maybe it varies all over the lot. You know, maybe there are times when it happens a lot more just for that reason. So he said it's entirely possible it's related. At the moment, we just can't see. Now, what he didn't tell me, but what I found out when I did some research on Pioneer Venus, is that Pioneer Venus has the same kinds of instruments, which I knew, but what I'd never thought about was Pioneer Venus is going at a time when sunspot activity is almost a maximum. Veteran 9 and 10 were there when it was almost a minimum. So that may be yet another thing we find out from Pioneer Venus. The other hole in this whole story is we seem to have a nice efficient mechanism for generating molecular oxygen in the upper atmosphere of Venus and nothing particular to destroy it. Where does it go? Same thing happens on Mars. On Mars, we know where it goes. It's enough circulation from the top to the middle, not bottom, but middle of the atmosphere, enough vertical circulation to carry the molecular oxygen down low enough that catalysts, which are remnants of photodissociated water vapor, eat it, break it up, destroying chemical reactions. On Venus, that may happen and it may not, and we just don't know. So this again may be one of the things that we find out from Pioneer Venus. And one of the more esoteric questions that we hope Pioneer Venus will answer is what happens to the oxygen on Venus? But you see, it could be a very important question to find out, because suppose there are circumstances in which you could have a planet where it doesn't happen. Then there is a major way to generate large amounts of molecular oxygen, and, you know, like tens of percent of molecular oxygen in the atmosphere without photosynthesis. If there are planets, if there could be planets, where nothing destroys the oxygen that is created in that way. So you start out with a carbon dioxide atmosphere and you end up with lots of molecular oxygen. And that could be very, very interesting for a whole bunch of different reasons. Like you could live there. And like you study some spectrum of some planet that gets discovered by the space telescope around some other star, and you discover oxygen in the atmosphere, and you get all excited because you think that means there's life there, and along comes somebody and says, no, see what happens is you get this photodissociation, and then you got to carry around the, you know, and nothing kills it, and so there it is. You know, oxygen, normally I think we would have just taken large amounts of molecular oxygen as proof of life on a planet, certainly as on Earth. We got time from what they tell me about when the janitors kick us out for one more question, and let me take it from this microphone.
Can you tell us anything about the joint French-Soviet mission plan for the other part of the next decade?
Yeah, I can tell you a little about it. Nobody seems to know very much. In fact, what people know even less about is whether the Russians are going to do something this year. It is a Venus launch window, after all. And there's every reason to think that they will, but Lanka asked the people that he worked with in Russia, you know, are you going to do anything for the 78 launch window? And they swore they didn't know, and Ronka says he believes them. He says the Soviets are so hung up on secrecy that they don't tell their own people what they're going to do next, let alone anybody else. So, the French, though, have announced a little bit about this. There is a joint French-Soviet effort to send something sometime in the early 1980s. It's still, you know, pretty much up in the air. In fact, it'll be literally up in the air, because what it will do is have something that is neither a probe, nor a lander, nor an orbiter, but a spacecraft which goes down into the atmosphere and then hangs in the atmosphere at a level probably just below the clouds by a balloon. And if there is one atmosphere that you could do good ballooning in, I imagine it's that of Venus, you know, because it's so dense. And dense in both senses. I mean, it's made of a heavy molecular weight gas, and there's a lot of that gas. So, other than that, nobody seems to know.